Well, ladies and gentlemen, two things. I hate to interrupt when people are talking because it's like, and two, it's really nice to have you come. It's nice to have you here. I mean, it's Obadiah. I mean, middle of Obadiah, middle of January, and you're here. So thank you very much for taking time to be here. Picking up where we left off last week, the first verse of Obadiah is basically a call to the nations to bring judgment. And so I'll read this right here. This is what the Sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord, an envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise up, let us go against her for battle. And so this was the message that was heard. What we've seen is God has sent out a message, if it be a spiritual angel, if it be a messenger, but calling the nations, maybe even an envoy, an ambassador going from nation to nation, they are coming against Edom. And the reason for it is because they're crimes against Judah. The next thing we're going to see as we go through this is their sin is pride. They're very confident of themselves, which is going to leave them blind. They will not see what's coming. And that goes on here. It says that in verse 2. See, I'll make you small among the nations. You'll be utterly despised. Again, there it says those are emphatic in the sense small and despised. The result of the nation coming against Edom, they will be small, they will be despised. That was emphatic in the Hebrew. Those two words begin the sentence. See, I'll make you small. Verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on the heights, who say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? And so their pride, again, is what's got them in a position where they're going to act in a way that is hubris and produce this thing called Hamas, violence against Judah or Jacob, it's social oppression. Verse 4, though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. And now we have here in verses 2 through 4, the first thing that God is going to attack is their defenses. Their home, their mountain fortresses are going to be lost. Verses 5 through 7, their treasures are going to be taken. And then verses 8 through 9 is going to talk about their leadership, mainly the wise men and then the military are going to be dismayed and confused. The treasures, let's go ahead and read verses 2 through 4. Okay, verse 5 through 7. And this is where we left off last week. It gives two examples of thieves and of harvesters. If thieves break in, they're in a rush. They'll go through things, take what they can find quickly, and get out. There's some things they leave behind because it's not worth staying and getting caught. People that are picking grapes or harvesters, they always leave some of the harvest behind for the poor of the land or for the travelers to get. That just was the law of the land. But when the Lord attacks through these nations, just like he's bringing Babylon against Judah, he's going to bring the nations against Edom for Edom participating in the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem. The thieves would use common sense. They wouldn't stay too long. Harvesters would follow the law and leave a little bit behind. But when these nations come through, they're going to go through thoroughly. In fact, it goes on and says, verse 5, if thieves came to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what a disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. And the idea there is they're going to go door to door, closet to closet. They're going to have plenty of time, and they're going to thoroughly lay it waste, even having a chance to find the hidden treasures. Even a thief comes in, they're not going to have time to search through all the hidden locations. They're going to grab what they can see and get out. But these people that are going to come in, these nations, will be able to go through and find the hidden treasures. Now, verse 7, well, let me read this here. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive you and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. Now, it says it three times. The idea there is because of the pride, they are blind. They will not detect because they think they're so great, they're so protected, that they also have allies. They will not detect that their allies are betraying them. And it says it in verse 7 three times, your allies will force you to the border. Now that means the people they've got allied, the nations they have alliances with, they're going to be the ones that are going to be doing the attacking. And they're going to force them to their border and out of their country. Number two, your friends will deceive and overpower you. You think they're coming for friendly means or friendly matters, but they will overpower you. Once again, friends coming and then overpowering and driving you away. And those who eat your bread will set a trap for you. You think you're having a friendly meal, a covenant meal. It's actually a trap. So they're deceived by their allies, their friends, and those who they're sharing bread with. And the main thing there is because of their pride. They didn't see it coming. So you can get upset with those that are breaking the treaties, but you can also see what God is saying. Your pride puts you in a blind spot, and you should have saw it coming. Now, verse 8 and 9, talking about the leadership, it mentions two groups, the wise men, and you get some notes from this from last week. In that day, the day that they fall, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau? And if you look at last week's notes, if you have them yet, I think, in fact, maybe are they on tonight's notes? Let me see. Yeah, it's on the first page of tonight's notes, page 6. It's the ones that I handed out tonight. It talks there about, at the bottom, the wise men are identified. And this is the land of the east. It comes up throughout the Bible, the Old Testament, that in the land of the east is where the wise men are. First of all, you can see Job chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And it describes him there. He was one of, in this land of Uz, it's over towards this way. You see Tema. You're also going to see Job chapter 2, verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And these are wise men, these are friends, these are sheikhs, if you would, at that time. And they're coming to share their wisdom. If you read the book of Job, it's full of wisdom. Some of it's theologically unsound and is rebuked by God. But these are the wise men, or examples of the wise men here in the east. Because of the trade routes that ran through Edom and their history going way back to the book of Genesis, they were an ancient people. They had gathered wisdom just from their own experience. They gathered wisdom from all the tribes' trade routes coming through. And so the wise, this was a land of wisdom. But these wise men, by this time, by 586 B.C., that wisdom has deteriorated into pride. And that's what it says right here. I'm reading verse 8. In that day, declares Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom? And he's going to probably destroy them with that pride. They're confident, and they're going to become arrogant, hubris with their wisdom. So there's that fine line of having wisdom to an extent, but then you start trusting your wisdom, not so much seeking wisdom, but thinking you have wisdom. It becomes hubris, leads to then social oppression. Men of understanding in the mountains of Esau will be confused. The next one, verse 9, your warriors, O Teman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in the slaughter. If you look at verse 9 on your note, that's the English Standard Version, it says, and your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. So the idea there again is they're going to be dismayed, they're going to be terrified, they're going to be overrun, and then it says they'll be cut off and cut down, or cut off or cut down. So they're going to be destroyed in this invasion. The country is going to be driven to the borders, their wise men are going to be confused, and their mighty men are going to be destroyed. And that is the three punishments that God is inflicting on Edom. Now, it's going to take place probably, like we said, during Nabonidus' time, 539, where the Arabs come in, the Nabataeans come in and drive them up into the Negev in southern Judah. They're going to abide there as Edomians until the time of the Maccabeans, the Hasmonean kings, when they're going to be invaded again and absorbed into Judah, forced into circumcision to obey the law, and then basically just get, you know, dissolved into the nations. Herod, of course, Herod the Great, his father Antipater, they are Edomians, or the remains of the Edomites. But after that time of the Romans, they're completely gone. So it wasn't a sudden fall. The fall of Judah, you can date that 586. There was a moment when the city was captured, the temple burnt. Nebuchadnezzar records the same date on his cuneiform tablets. But this fall of Edom, it happened in a series of events that take place, you know, finally collapsing totally or being lost in history during the days of the Romans, but of course driven out of the land in 539. Now, that is their punishment that's going to take place. And it's being prophesied by, again, here in the book of Obadiah, but also we see it in Jeremiah, we see it in Ezekiel. But now we get into, on the bottom of page 7 of your notes, it's the bottom of the first page, it's just numbered 7, it says, now begin the list of Edom's crimes. What did they do? And it's fairly significant. It's fairly severe if you look at it. I will read it right out of the NIV, verses 10 through 14 right now. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. So it's going to take place. There is going to be shame. Their fall is going to be a shameful fall, meaning all their history is going to end in shame, and their fall is going to be forever. Like the fate of any kind of a nation that God punishes, it's removed, it never recovers. So Edom's ending is going to be in shame, and their loss will be forever. And the reason for that is this right here: violence done to your brother Jacob. The word violence, you can see it there in the Hebrew text, is the word Hamas. It's a form of the word Hamas. It's I'm looking here on page 8 at the top. You can see you got to read from the right to the left, right by the number 10. It's Mahamas, which it translates for violence. And that is a word violence. Specifically, it is social oppression. It is someone being arrogant, or again, in hubris, the typical pride of Edom, of where they think they have the right to oppress other people. It's basically they begin to think like they are the elite. Now again, you will have elite people in culture, but when the elite people begin to think they have rights to oppress others, they deserve to oppress others. I mean, there's always going to be rulers, like a teacher in the classroom realizes that they're the teacher, they're responsible, they're in charge. But a teacher can drift into pride, start thinking themselves as elite, that they have the right to oppress the children because they're the teacher. That's just an example. Meaning we can't just say you can't have any leadership, can't have any rulers, there's no such thing as elite. It's when these elite become oppressive because they think they have the right and they can justify it because of, if it be position, if it be wealth, if it be race. Here, in this case right here, Edom has got themselves in a place of pride where they think they are just better and they deserve, it's fair what they are doing. And they are bringing social violence, Hamas, and here's the word it goes with. It goes with the right beside the word brother, which is even the sentence Hamas against your brother. I mean, there's no, you are equals. There's no, it's not like you're even the teacher in a classroom or the elite over the masses. You are equals. You are brothers. And in that condition, you can maybe understand it's still not justified and still punishable in the scriptures. You can understand why someone that's an elite or a government official or someone that's superior in some way would think, I've got the right to bring oppression. But Edom was Jacob's brother, or Esau was Jacob's brother, or Edom was, again, relatives to the people of Judah. And they are bringing their Hamas to a brother, which makes this even more ridiculous. And that's what it says right here. It says, verse 10, because of the violence against your brother, again, the Hamas against your brother, you will be covered with shame and will be destroyed forever. Now, once again, this is a prophecy. Divine inspiration has led to this. It was some kind of they heard the word of the Lord. It says in verse 1, it's the vision of Obadiah. So it's inspired, but at the same time, it's obvious. I mean, this is the way the world works. You act this way. In fact, look in verse 15. As we get done talking about what our subject tonight, this is how we will end tonight. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. And then it says this. It describes the day of the Lord for all nations, specifically here about Edom, with two lines. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. I mean, that's not like some secret wisdom, secret knowledge. That is a basic principle of life. I mean, even the world has that, the concept of karma. You know, Jesus says what you sow, or Paul said what you sow, what you will reap. Jesus says similar things. In fact, draws out of this same idea here. And so, this book, of course, is revelation. It is a vision. It's what the Lord spoke. But he's not speaking anything that's like, wow, you better write that down. The wise men of Edom had things like that written down. They're basic proverbs, basic principles. As you have done, it will be done to you. Which kind of identifies what the day of the Lord is going to be for the nations. How the nations have reacted and treated God's creation, God's reality, God's people. Well, that's what you're going to get. It's going to what you reap is what you're going to sow. Your deeds will return upon your own head. It's basic judgment. And so, because, in verse 10, because of the violence against your brother, you'll be covered with shame and destroyed forever. This is your fate. Because of what you did, this is your fate. And now, we've already identified the phrase or the word Hamas, but now we're going to get a list of 10, 1 through 10 things that we're going to read through. I've got them listed on here. I've got a little chart there on bottom, on the bottom of page 10. The 10 crimes of Hamas that we're going to read through right now. And I'll read verses 10 through 14, and you'll hear them, and then I'm going to stop and just identify them. Verse 10 of Obadiah. Because of the violence, Hamas, against your brother, your equal, Jacob, you'll be covered with shame and will be destroyed forever. And here's what they did. On the day you stood aloft, while strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates, and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not look down on your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor look down on them in the day of calamity, in the day of their distress, nor seize their wealth. In the day of their disaster, you should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand their survivors, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. Now, if you look in the English Standard Version, the first thing you can see is in verse 11 on page 8, on the day that you stood aloft. So, what they did, the first, and you can see these, they break these into four groups. It starts off with them, one, standing aloft. Now, they're watching. They're seeing the invasion. They're seeing the destruction coming. Armies are surrounding. Judah is in trouble. And they're watching, observing. But they pretty soon realize that this is Jerusalem's fate, that Nebuchadnezzar is not going to be defeated by Judah, and they will fall, which leads to them not just standing aloft at a distance watching the city burn or watching the looters or whatever, but the very next thing right there, on the day that you stood aloft, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates. So they're standing aloft while Babylon, foreigners, are entering the gates. They're entering Jerusalem. And three, they're carrying off plunder. And then the next thing you see right there is they're now dividing Jerusalem. Jerusalem is now being partialed out. Now, who's going to rule what? Who's going to get part of what section? From Nebuchadnezzar down through his generals all the way down to the governors that they're going to put in place, Jerusalem now it needs new ownership. It needs new oversight from the governor that's going to oversee it, from who's going to manage the different parts of the city, who's going to set up businesses. It's now being divided up who's going to occupy it. And you can see that on the day you stood aloft, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. And so when these things are happening, entering, plundering, and dividing, the foreigners are doing that. Guess what the aloft standing became? They joined in and they became like them. They participated. That's your first indication that Esau or Edom was standing. Now, who is this? Is it the public? Is it the military? Is it, you know, caravans? It doesn't give us specific who was doing this, but somehow Edom as a nation was standing and watching when they saw Babylon's carrying things off, entering the gate, dividing up the city. They're like, hey, it's a free-for-all. They participated. They would have somehow entered the city gates. Someone from Edom did. They would have carried off some plunder, and they would have tried to get some kind of a hold on property or some district or some jurisdiction, some business. They were just like them. Instead of standing aloft and going, oh, that's not right, they're like, I don't think anyone's watching. I think we can participate, and they were like one of them. So that's your opening statement about what's about to take place. So the first two crimes I wrote down, Edom's number one crime of Hamas, Edom stood aloft while Judah was invaded. And then number two, on the bottom of page 8, Edom was like one of the Babylonians. Soon they're participating. Now verse 12, this now becomes more of an attitude of what were they thinking? What was their attitude? Now, as I read this and I was studying this, you can see in your own heart. I mean, all this is useful for seeing God's nature, what took place in history, how He's going to judge nations. But ultimately, it's a little bit of self-reflection, I know for myself, especially when you look down at that verse 15, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. That's not a statement about nations. That's God from the biggest to the smallest. It's what goes around comes around. And I'm now looking at myself, and you can see, they're standing aloft. I'm not involved. Then it's like, well, no one's really paying attention. Maybe I will cash in and get a little bit for myself. And now comes the attitude that they had. It says, but do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of their misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of their distress. So here comes the next set, 3, 4, and 5. They were gloating over that. It's like they're happy it's taking place. Do not gloat in the day of your brother, in the day of his misfortune. So I'm glad it's happening to them and not me. They probably deserve it. And if they deserve it, that just justifies my Hamas. If they deserve that kind of treatment, well, then I'll go get some more for myself. The next one, do not rejoice over the people of Judah. Rejoice. Wow, this is a great defeat because it's going to open some doors for me. I'm gloating. Now they deserve it. I'm rejoicing because now I'm going to get something. And then the next one, it says, do not boast in the day. Now they're boasting. Now what are you boasting about? This is between Israel's or Judah's sin, the Babylonians invading, and God orchestrating it, and you're boasting. It's like, How did you, you're standing aloft, you're just watching from a distance. But now you end up, through this whole series of events, you're gloating. Ah, you're justifying what's happening to them. I'm glad they deserve that. You're rejoicing because, you know, this might open some doors for me. I may get a little bit of what they've lost. And now you're boasting, you know what? I stinking deserve this. This is my share. And gloating, rejoicing, boasting. Now is that second verse about what they're doing. And you can just see them continuing to stumble into their disaster by the very fact they're standing aloft, not helping defend their brother, and then realizing when he's falling, they started participating. They began to justify their actions. He deserved to be destroyed. This is going to open some doors for me. This is a great opportunity. And now you're boasting about yourself and how you deserve this. And so that's what you have. The next three on page 9, I just wrote basically what I did on the board. Crime 3, 4, and 5, Edom gloated over Jerusalem's misfortune. Edom rejoiced over the ruin of Judah. Edom boasted of themselves in the day Jerusalem fell. How does that have anything to do with them? And notice this, and the next verse begin with, do not being spoken to Edom. These are the sins of a mocking attitude right here. And do notice in the boxes in the Hebrew there, each verse 12, I got a little square drawn there, 12, 13, and 14, the opening word is not. God, the emphatic word in this verse right here is not gloat, rejoice, or boast. You should not. The next verse begins the same way. Not. It says you should not do this. And the next one is not. The verse 12, 13, and 14 all begin with the word not. And you can see that in the Hebrew. I'll read the Hebrew. I'll read the literal translation. But not you should have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity, nor should you have rejoiced over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of their distress. And so again, that's their attitude, and it all leads back to themselves. Now, that's verse 12, verse 13. You can see it progressing now. That was their attitude. Now, verse 13. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. And do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. So now, because of their attitude, they've now gone to 6, 7, and 8. And one, they are now entering the gate. They are someone from Edom. Now, again, if it's a military expedition, if it's traitors that have come up, if it's someone that has sided with the Babylonians, some kind of political connection, whatever, someone from Edom has gone into the gate. They've gone into the city. It's probably burning. You think about riots. You see in some city that's on fire and there's riots. It's like, well, that's not right. Well, you know what? This city, it deserved it. I'm getting in my car and I'm heading over there, and now you're going through the burning remains of the buildings, finding out what you can do. It's like, do not enter the gate. You're boasting about this, thinking you're responsible. You deserve this. They deserve this. And now you've actually crossed into their city. You're trespassing in territory. Again, especially since you're coming out of Edom, a country that's got its own borders, and you're coming up into Judah, a country that God has given borders to. Even Moses, and you know that we've talked about it, when Moses came out of the wilderness, he wanted to pass through Edom. He wanted to stay right on the king's highway. He even sent the king a letter. I want to pass through. We won't eat anything. We'll pick up our trash. You won't even know we're there. King said no. So Moses said, oh my gosh, we're going to have to go all the way around Edom. So he sends another letter, a little more diplomatic, and makes some more promises. We'll bring our own water. We won't use your wells. And they said no, but this time they came out with an army and stood on the border and said no, with the military standing there. And God says, well, Moses, you need to go around Edom. Now, again, God had just delivered them out of Egypt, and now all Moses wants to do is just walk through the land. And Edom said, we don't want you in our land. God says, well, it's their land. That's how much respect God had for the borders of a nation, is he made Moses and the chosen people walk around Edom. Even after Moses had asked twice, God says, if you do it, it won't be good for you. I won't be with you. So they had to walk around. Well, now Edom, while Judah's being destroyed by Babylon, Edom actually leaves their border and goes into the border of Judah to grab stuff. So you can understand, God is protecting Judah in a similar way as he was protecting Edom. And I think, if you want to take a lesson on nations and borders and territories and God's vision, there you have it. And if you're going to not respect one of the crimes, if it be the Babylonian tablets, the cuneiform writings, or the writings in the Bibles, writings of Moses, even the prophets, talking about borders and moving property lines and border lines, it was met with a vengeance, because someone could go out and start moving borders around, you know, stones that marked territory. And it was a huge crime. And it was that way in God's eyes too. So, now, in 6, 7, and 8, this next verse, verse 13, they've entered the gates when Jerusalem fell. Now, why are they entering the gates? Not just to get some photographs or something, or some selfies. They're entering the gate to see what they can get. And again, gloated over Judah's disaster. If you read it in the Hebrew, again, just reading the translation, not you should have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. I mean, there's no way, no one can defend it. Not should you have gazed indeed in the day of their affliction, of their calamity, nor, laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. So they're in the gates. Once again, they're gloating. And that gloating is, aha, they deserve this. They don't deserve this anymore. They deserve the punishment. They don't deserve the property. And so now they're going to take it, because it's not theirs anymore. You can't say this belongs to Judah because Judah's been destroyed. We'll just take that. You can see they entered the gate. They justified their behavior, and they took the stuff, looted the wealth on the day of his calamity. And now verse 14, the most serious of these, number 9 and 10. And as Jerusalem is falling, and again, it took several months, a couple of years, as far as all with the famine and everything, and the invading armies, and invading people looking for food before the Babylon army actually even got there. People were fleeing the country. First, they fled to Jerusalem because there's nowhere else to go. And then as the Babylonian armies began to march in, the people began to flee, run away from the city, trying to get out. Just like Jesus told his disciples, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, run to the mountains, get out of town in 70 AD and also in the future. Well, there was indeed people fleeing. A classic example is Zedekiah, the last king of Babylon. When the city fell, he fled out some secret passageway. The kings always had secret passageways. There was indeed a passageway from the king's palace up to the Temple Mount that's referred to different times. So they could be in the palace, the royal palace, and then go through a certain doorway, a certain corridor hallway, and then come up and emerge on the Temple Mount. They would not have to go out into the public street and walk up the same way everybody else did. They had their own access. And as you know, underneath Mount Moriah and in all those stones, there's passageways. Sometimes they're natural caves. And you've heard about, or I know I've been in, Zedekiah. It's called Zedekiah's Cave. It's where they actually quarried stone underneath. It's the northeast quadrant of the old city of Jerusalem. It's the Muslim quarter now. And you can go underneath the city wall into these caverns. And Tony and I have been in there a couple times. And you can still see the chippings from when they carved out under the city stones to be brought up and put into buildings and into the temple. There's still just chips from the stones. You can see where they've cut squares out and begin bring stuff out, and it goes deep. Tony and I went in there, and we went deep and deep and further, and we're well under the city of Jerusalem, until finally it's like, Tony says, how are we going to know how to get out? I said, well, we're going down. We'll just start walking up and get back out. But then we got to a place where it's like, okay, this is far enough. I mean, you could have just kept right on going. And the theory was, and again, they've done excavation, is those caves have to come out somewhere. And people have done exploring, and they're real cave explorers. And they are connected to other caverns and passages that take you all the way out of the city, out into the wilderness. And Zedekiah was captured. You can read it in the account of the scriptures. He was captured by Babylonian troops on the plains of Jericho. So he emerged somewhere east in the plains of towards Jericho. Now, where he popped up out of those caves, we don't know, but he went into the caves and came out, or went into some passageway. You could very easily have had a passageway in the palace that took you out. Sometimes it would go south out some kind of a pass, what do you call it? Not a citizen, but a pedestrian gate going out of the city. Anyway, that goes on and on. I could talk about that more. But nonetheless, in 586 and the years before, the months before, people were fleeing Jerusalem and Judah and heading down south. Just like the wise men who came into Jerusalem, went down to Bethlehem, and when they were told in a dream, don't go home the same way you came, they came from the north into, probably coming, through the hill country into Jerusalem. Now they're in Bethlehem. They probably went south, down around, through Edom, down around the Dead Sea, and escaped into the wilderness on their, not the wilderness, but the desert on their camels, and Herod couldn't catch them. That's exactly what these people are going to do. They're going to be fleeing the city. hundreds of, just imagine a city that is falling. Many people are going to die in the streets and die in their homes, but many people are going to see it coming and head for the hills. They're going to take off. And thus you have verse 15. This is something else Edom did. I'm on page, verse 14, I mean. Bottom of page 9, reading the English Standard Version. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. So they are killing the refugees fleeing the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. There's Jews fleeing down towards Edom, and that's very obvious that would be taking place. And they're just cutting them off. They're killing them. Not helping them, not giving them shelter, but just executing them because they're fugitives. They are now enemies of the new king. They're now criminals. They're escaping. Now watch how fast. They're actually their brothers. And again, you can see this happening. They're just, you know, one day they're brothers, they're equals, they're nations. But all of a sudden, because that nation is falling and this new king is chasing them, you now side with the new king, and now what used to be your brother is now a criminal and worthy of being slaughtered as they flee the destruction. I mean, be careful how politics sways your opinion, because Edom said, well, they used to be our brother, but now because Nebuchadnezzar's chasing them, we'll kill them. It's like, well, nothing's changed between you and Jacob. It's just Nebuchadnezzar has changed or is there on the scene. And then the next thing it says, do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. And watch this. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of disaster. So they're also capturing and they're fleeing the Babylonian troops. Well, Edom would capture. Now, again, some of the people of Edom are up in the city gate. Taking stuff. Some are still down in Edom or along the ways, the roadways, the crossroads, executing them or killing them, and then sometimes capturing them and then giving them back to the military of the Babylonians, thinking they're going to get a reward, thinking they're going to get favor. And indeed, they may have gotten some stuff. They may have gotten some property. They may have gotten some rewards from the Babylonians, but all this together, God is calling it Hamas. It is violence against an equal brother, and there we have it now. My point 4 on page 9 at the bottom, sins of trespassing and plundering since Edomites had come into the land to gloat. Do not stand at the crossroads. Point 3 on page 10, sins against the people themselves. And then I mentioned something about Zedekiah there. And there I've got on page 10 all these crimes listed. Here's the 10 crimes of Edom. They stood aloft while Judah was invaded. Then they became like with the Babylonians themselves. They gloated over Jerusalem's misfortune. They rejoiced over the ruin of Judah. They boasted of themselves in the day Jerusalem fell. Then they entered the gates of Jerusalem when it fell. They gloated over Judah's disaster again because they deserved it. They looted Jerusalem's wealth when it fell. Then they cut off Jews fleeing as fugitives from Jerusalem and then handed over surviving Jews that had been captured. They handed them to the Babylonian forces. And now chapter or verse 15, that's what they did. And God compares this now to the day of the Lord. I do not know why all of a sudden my board does this, if it's the weather or if it's someone tried to clean the board or whatever. The day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is near. And in this case, we're going to be talking about for Edom. But this day of the Lord is going to eventually be a universal day for all nations. Chapter or verse 15 of Obadiah. For the day of the Lord is near upon all nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return upon your own head. It's the law of retribution. It's the day of the Lord is near for all nations. But in this case right here, we're talking about Edom in particular, because Edom will not be there in the ultimate day of the Lord, and he comes to judge the nations at Armageddon. Edom will already have been eliminated from history. So this is a classic example of a nation that has rebelled against God, used Hamas in their rulership, their leadership, and how they're dealt with the Lord through history. All nations that are in rebellion will end up in the same fate. And again, the law of retribution, as they have done. And I write on page 11, principles of retaliation is spoken here. Point A, as you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deed shall return on your own head. That's, again, if you wonder how God is going to judge, again, how He's going to evaluate your life, of course, there's righteousness in Christ. Christ paid for our sins. But as far as evaluation goes, as you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. And I do not think Christians escape that because, well, we're saved, Christ has paid for our sins. There is going to be, in life and in some kind of, in an eternal sense, there's going to be loss of reward, loss of opportunities because of our attitudes, because of the things we've done. Or there's going to be rewards and opportunities afforded to us because what we have done. This is not just negative. It goes in the positive sense. And point two, Edom will reap what they have sown, a basic principle of life. God is just, and Edom will face an equally devastating fate. They had their moment in 586 B.C. when they sided with the Babylonians, but everything they did, 1 through 10, is going to come back, and by 539 will begin having taken effect, and by 150 they will be absorbed into Judah themselves. And what's interesting, what we're going to get to in the next verses next time, is by 150 Judah is back in the land, the Hasmoneans are ruling, and a lot of this final work against Edom is going to be done by Judah itself as they bring judgment. Now, verse 16 and 17, I'll read this, and then we'll pick this up next week. It says, "For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they had never been." So, again, that's talking about, as you have drunk on my holy mountain, they may have gone up to, you know, drink the wine, drink something celebrated on Mount Moriah as Jerusalem burnt, where the temple used to stand. It says, "So all nations shall drink continually." That's the state of nations, is continually drinking in something they shouldn't be, but it's drinking in the wrath. "They shall drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been." In other words, the very fact that you're rebelling against God, going places you shouldn't go, taking things, authority, creating realities that aren't real, your punishment is going to be elimination. It'll be as if you never existed. The alternative is verse 17, "But in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy." And who's going to escape? Judah's being taken into captivity, going to be protected in Babylon, and then brought back by Cyrus's decree. "And they shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions." In the end, Judah is coming back. Edom is going to be as the nations, as if they never were. But Judah is protected. They will return, and they'll take up their own possessions. In fact, the rest of the book, if you read verses 19 through 21, it's all about Israel expanding their territory when they come back from captivity. And in verse 18, it's going to be talking about Jacob, the house of Jacob, and the house of Joseph being the fire that burns the stubble of Esau. So at this time, in 586, there's really no indication in history that Judah or the Jews are ever going to be a force again. But the book of Obadiah ends by saying, yeah, they will be back. In fact, they'll be there to bring about the final destruction of Esau after they've been run out of their country by their allies. Judah will return, along with Joseph, to bring an end to them and be the fire to burn it. And that would speak of historical events, but also ultimately in the end, when you read about those wars in the book of Zechariah about Judah and the house of David fighting with the Lord against the nations that have come against Jerusalem. Again, I think we're talking there about the Battle of Armageddon, from looking at it from different positions, angles. Again, this book has two factors. One, it's talking historically to Edom, but also then you step back and look at it from the universal position historically. It's talking about this is the way it's going to be in the end. So there we have right there tonight. We just talked about the crimes that Edom had committed. That brought about those three punishments that are going to come, and Edom's going to be overthrown. Again, like I said in the previous weeks, this seems to have been a big deal for the people of this time, because Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Obadiah, even the Psalms speak against Edom about this and being so unjust. And it serves for us as an example of the end times, but also just think about your own life, but think about our nation's life. And it could be any time, anybody, but you can see things today in our own country of this group of the elite. If there are political leaders or if there are people that are in charge of corporations that are supposed to be helping our nation, helping our society, helping civilization, and they see themselves as getting more and more powerful, and they begin to bring oppression, they begin to bring a false reality. You can even see the separation of there's laws for the common, but then there's exceptions for all their special favors or people or situations that they want to protect. So that is really, it becomes right there, and this helps us understand this, lawlessness. And lawlessness is where the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, is not just a man that's breaking all the laws, but in the sense that the laws are subjective. It's like, what do you want? Like if a police officer pulls you over because you're speeding, it's kind of like you're disappointed. You wish he'd let you go, but you understand it's the law. I mean, there's the facts. This is the standard. You're going too fast. Here's your ticket. Have a nice day, sir. It's the law, and you understand that you can function there. But lawlessness is basically, what is the law? Well, you're still going to get pulled over, but you don't know what you got pulled over for other than the fact that it's just some kind of Hamas, some kind of social oppression. Now, that person doesn't get pulled over. We're not going to pull that person over, but we're going to pull you over. What did I do? Well, you're you. You can't find a reason. You can't put this into some kind of court system and have a judicial decision, because it's subjective. And I think that's kind of part of the culture of the final days, is lawlessness, just arbitrary whatever. And that's part of the Hamas generation, is lawlessness. There's standards and enforcement, but it's more about who's in control, who's got the power to enforce it, but it's not going to be fair. It's not going to be just. And it's hard for us as Americans, I think, to wrap our mind around that, because we've lived, in a sense, in a culture that has a judicial system. When you go back into other empires or countries, even around the world today, you can see it's more arbitrary. It's like, who do you know? Who are you? And you've got this classes of people. And I think that you're looking at here, you can see that breaking loose here in Obadiah with Edom, and then the punishment that comes on them, just like people that are living today in a lawless system. It's not going to be like that forever, because when the king returns, he will judge and rule in justice. And so you may want to create a lawless situation, but it's not real. It cannot last. The good news is you may have to live through that. You may have to experience something like that. Judah did, but it's not eternal. There is right and wrong. There is the judge, and he will make the playing field even, make it fair, and he, with justice, he judges and makes war. And so that's reality. So you may see some things challenging reality, but it will be defeated. The false reality will be defeated ultimately. The man of lawlessness will be overcome with the appearing of Jesus Christ, and he will perish. I'll pray, and we're finished. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we would find encouragement and direction for our own life, that we'd be able to stand firm in the face of opposition. But Father, in our own case, that we would not be those who turn to Hamas or turn to our own pride, to bring about our own opinions and our own desires, but Father, that we would walk in your ways, walk in your reality, and bear the fruit of your Spirit in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being here.